hour or two. We're getting the word ahead of the match in Newbridge tomorrow evening at 5:30 from Kildare and from the Leinster leader. So we'll talk about that in a moment. There's a wider context, though, and a political element to what the GAA have been doing and talking about. This week, members of the GAA spoke before the Oireachtas Committee on Rural Affairs, and they talked about demographics. Specifically, they talked about And No One Shouted Stop, the report which we referenced on this programme a couple of months ago, which details the crisis that's unfolding in terms of player numbers, both in urban areas, too many players for the clubs involved, this is children we're talking about, and in rural areas, not enough. Dr. Peter Horgan, who was with the GAA and was part of a panel that spoke to the TDs and senators, spoke and talked about the issues that they need the help of the government to deal with. Have a listen.
Ireland is undergoing profound demographic change. Population growth is increasingly concentrated along the eastern seaboard, with commuter belts and larger urban settlements, while many rural communities are experiencing ageing populations, declining birth rates, outward migration of younger adults, and shrinking volunteer capacity. These changes are reshaping communities across the island. The central message we wish to leave the committee with today is straightforward. Demographic change is no longer solely a population issue, it's now a community sustainability issue. It affects where the communities retain the schools, clubs, voluntary organisations, services and social connections that allow them to remain vibrant and resilient. The GAA, alongside the LGFA and Camogie Association, represents more than 2,300 clubs, over 760,000 members across the island of Ireland. These clubs are embedded in towns, villages, parishes, cities and neighbourhoods in every county. While they provide opportunities for sport and physical activity, they also perform a wider societal role. They are places where people volunteer, participate, connect with one another, and develop a sense of belonging. From our perspective, demographic change is already visible within communities. In many rapidly growing urban and commuter settlements, clubs are experiencing unprecedented demand. Facilities are oversubscribed, volunteers are under increasing pressure, and community infrastructure is struggling to keep pace with population growth. At the same time, many rural clubs face declining underage numbers, reduced volunteer capacity, and growing uncertainty regarding long-term sustainability. The challenge is therefore not simply one of growth or decline. Rather, it's a growing imbalance between where people live and where community infrastructure exists. The demographic evidence highlights the scale of this challenge. Almost one third of the population of the island now lives within the wider Dublin commuter belt. More than 43% lives along the eastern seaboard. Nearly two thirds of the population lives either on the eastern seaboard or within towns and cities of more than 10,000 population. Perhaps the clearest indication of future trends can be seen in the distribution of young children. Our analysis shows that just 50 club catchment areas now account for one quarter of all children aged between 0 and 5 on the island, while 1,000 clubs share only 22% of that cohort. This is significant because children represent more than future players, they're future pupils, volunteers, community leaders and active citizens. Where young families disappear, schools weaken, clubs weaken, volunteer capacity declines and local services become increasingly difficult to sustain. What begins as a demographic challenge can quickly become a challenge for community viability. This is why the GAA believes that Gaelic games should be recognised not solely as a sport, but as a form of social, community and cultural infrastructure. Recent independent research estimated the participation and volunteering in Gaelic games generated almost 2.9 billion in social value across the island of Ireland in a single year, with every euro invested generating approximately 2.3 euros in social value. The benefits identified include improved health and well-being, stronger social connections, volunteering, civic participation and community cohesion. For the GAA, these findings reinforce an important point. Gaelic games are amongst Ireland's largest forms of preventative social infrastructure. Every week, clubs bring together children, young people, parents, volunteers and older adults. They provide opportunities for physical activity, leadership, social participation and community engagement. They create spaces where people can build friendships, develop confidence and contribute positively to community life. This contribution is highly relevant to the committee's remit. Many of the challenges facing Ireland today, including loneliness, social isolation, youth disengagement, mental health concerns and ageing population, cannot be addressed through financial supports alone. They also require strong local institutions that foster participation, belonging and social connection. Community organisations such as GAA clubs provide precisely these opportunities. The contribution of Gaelic games also extends beyond social outcomes to encompass culture and identity. Gaelic games are among Ireland's most distinctive indigenous cultural traditions. Through their connections to place, parish and community, clubs help sustain local identity and collective belonging. The continued vitality of these traditions depends not only on preserving the games themselves, but on sustaining the communities in which they're played. Housing policy is another area where the GAA believes a stronger community sustainability perspective is required. Housing is rightly discussed in terms of supply, affordability and delivery. However, housing policy also influences where the communities have the population base necessary to sustain schools, clubs, voluntary organisations and local services. In rapidly growing areas, housing development has frequently outpaced the provision of community infrastructure. In many rural areas, the challenge is maintaining sufficient numbers of young people to sustain existing community assets and institutions.
There you go. That's just a little bit of what Dr. Peter Horgan said to the Oireachtas Committee on Rural Affairs during the week. And pretty stark numbers, pretty stark figures there. We'll be talking about that, amongst other things, with Call from the Dáil, which is on the way.
Call from the Dáil on Kerry Today with John Downing.
John Downing with me on the line. John Downing, that was really, they weren't putting a tooth in it, the GAA, and with their report on No One Shouted Stop, echoing the incredible book in 1968 by John Healy, I think it was, talking about Charlestown and County Mayo, they're spelling out the figures there. And I was watching the coverage during the week of that, and I was kind of wishing that every politician in Leinster House would have been at that meeting, or at least paid attention to it, because you're talking, yes, about the GAA, but really you're talking about the problems we have in Ireland across all sorts of different sectors when it comes to the demographic shift. Too many people on the East Coast, too many people in Dublin, services overwhelmed there as a result, not enough people on the West Coast. That figure alone, 50 clubs trying to cater for 25% of all of the children that they cater for in the country in GAA terms, and 1,000 clubs, and you can guess where they are, on the West Coast, yeah, in the Midlands and rural areas, having to do with 22% of the children, which is just, it's not sustainable, is it?
No, it's not. And we're talking on a weekend of, you know, a huge weekend. Gee, I mean, right, we have the World Cup and all the rest, but there are 24 counties playing this weekend, including Kerry, playing in Newbridge. So it is a huge issue. And, you know, I know places on the East Coast which are completely overrun. I live in Newbridge, where this match is going to be played tomorrow. By the way, the women footballers of both Kildare and Kerry will also be playing.
Yeah.
But you see, I see houses going up all over the place, and I see there are two clubs in this town, and I don't know, I mean, already they are, you know, under severe pressure to be able to provide. Now, you know, you'd sort of say people, GAA enthusiasts on the West Coast would say, well, we should wish to have that problem, but it's not actually, it's not real, because there's only so much can be done. There's only so many pitches, so many dressing rooms, and so many volunteers to look after these young boys and girls, you know, playing hurling and football. So it is a ginormous problem, and he touched on it there, of course, when he talked about housing, because if you don't have houses, if you don't have jobs, how do you sustain clubs on the Western seaboard? And similarly, you know, you're up against a different manifestation of the same problem on the East Coast. I mean, yeah, two clubs just leap out at me, Kilmacud Crokes, the Sevens, traditionally before the All-Ireland finals. You go up there, my God, what a complex, what a size, yeah, what an organisation. Similarly, Naas in County Kildare, apparently the second largest club. I mean, they have huge, dramatic facilities. For example, the election counts for North Kildare and Kildare generally are often held in the Naas GAA club, because it's a fabulous facility. But again, even there, that place is under pressure. So you have, you know, the population imbalance is very fundamental. And, you know, the GAA has to, and other sporting organisations, rugby, soccer, the others, but especially the GAA, because it's the heart of the beating heart of the country, town and country. So, you know, their take on life, on social issues, is vital.
Yeah, worth listening to.
And it needs to be listened to.
And the one area we're seeing it is alongside GAA clubs, you're also going to see it in schools. 7 years, 8 years' time, there's going to be a real crunch in terms of a lack of numbers. That was actually delayed, yeah, by the arrival of Ukrainians in 2022, which saved several schools, but that's going to work its way through the system. So I suppose the thing is, are the Department of Education paying attention to this? I know the Department of Housing are trying to do something about it, but is there enough attention being put on it, I wonder, by the politicians?
I hate to be negative. I'm obviously in this studio on a Friday morning. But sometimes I wonder, does the Department of Education even keep an eye on the census figures?
Yeah.
You know, the numbers of births in a given year, that's going to tell you how many, baby school, primary school places you're going to need five, six years hence, and so on. Yeah. And suddenly you find here on the East Coast, you find a terrible scramble for school places and lack. And on the West Coast, every day we hear that, you know, such a school is under pressure. I was listening to schools in Donegal yesterday, you know, talk of the numbers have fallen below, and there's a case being made for them to lower the threshold and keep the school going, you know. So it's not easy, this one, you know, but it is very urgent.
Needs more attention, that's for sure. John, a lot of attention this week on the EU Migration Pact. It comes into force today, 2 years after it was adopted by Member States and the European Parliament. Our piece of legislation in relation to this comes into impact as well today. Jim O'Callaghan lauding it. Now, both the EU Migration Pact and our interpretation of it are getting attacked on all sides by both the far right and those, I suppose, who would be seen to the far left, maybe, including, I suppose, refugee organisations. They're all unhappy with it. Does that mean they might have got this right, or is that too simplistic of you?
You kind of took the words out of my mouth. This is a very difficult piece of legislation. It's a very fraught issue. Again, like the other one we were just talking about, it's at the heart of human behaviour. And this one goes back, really, the current huge crisis goes back to 2015. I was only writing about it last night. The young child who was washed up on the beach in Turkey, a Syrian little boy, 2 years and 2 months old. That was 1 million people came to Europe in the year 2015. Vastly above the numbers in the previous year. We have it here, of course, even aside from the numbers of Ukrainians, in excess of 100,000, a bit fewer than that at present for various reasons. But the others, the people fleeing, those numbers are huge also. So, if you get whatever you do, it took basically 10 years and two goals for the EU to get agreement. It's the definitive EU issue. National initiatives are not enough. It has to be taken on an EU basis.
Yeah.
I mean, years ago we had the Dublin Convention, that thing agreed in 1990, which turned out to be well-intentioned, but a nonsense in reality. It was that it was the obligation of the first country where people landed to deal with that. Well, you look at the geography of Ireland, how can Ireland be the first EU state in which people from Afghanistan, Africa, it's a nonsense. So, I mean, that's been put aside, and now there is cooperation, and the immediate frontline states who fear that they've got a really bad deal, and they have, in a sense, Greece and Italy and Spain and some of the others, because they are really the first line. So there has to be a sharing and a support
for them across the whole of whole of the EU. John, we're going to hold it there. We're going to talk a bit more about this and a few other issues to get to. We'll get to those things after we take these.
Call from the Dáil on Kerry Today with John Downing.
Now, we're talking with John Downing on Call from the Dáil. And John, the EU Migration and Asylum Pact, on the base of it, it secures EU's external borders, provides a fast, efficient asylum process, a shared responsibility, which you mentioned, for migration and asylum between all EU member states, international partnerships on migration. There'll be new screening procedures. Everyone will be screened who enters illegally. Identity security, health, vulnerability checks, if a person can be placed in the appropriate procedure. Have a border procedure for asylum applicants who are unlikely to need protection or mislead the authority. And all of those sort of things are promised. I have a question here from a listener who says, just a quick question for you and John regarding the new migration pact. If applicants are unsuccessful, where is the third safe country for return? Is it within the EU or outside it? Now, my understanding, John, is that it would be outside it, but that hasn't been nailed down. There's some talk of Asia or Africa, these so-called safe return hubs. And that's where some of the criticism has come in from the refugee organisation side, saying this is like the UK's Rwanda policy of a couple of years ago.
Yeah, and there are, Italy has been in talks with Albania. Some of the others have been in talks with Tunisia. And yes, there are legitimate questions about the countries, other so-called third countries, non-EU countries, about their will and their capacity to secure the rights and the care of the proper care, the security and the human rights of asylum seekers and refugees. And that is very contentious. And as you say, it lacks clarity in that. Also talks with transit countries, countries where, for example, somebody coming from Afghanistan would have, you know, a heap of countries to come through. Similarly, somebody from Syria and so on. We have to understand that frequently these people are so desperate and they're fleeing. And also, I often wonder, I talked to an industrialist who was pretty right-wing on economic matters and even some social matters. He argues that if these people go through literally fire and water to make it to our shores, imagine what kind of contribution they can make to society, economically, socially, culturally. That argument is there. It's a very difficult one, but it is very clear that a line has to be drawn on numbers, and systems have to be more robust, but they must continue to be fair. It's a difficult balancing act.
And the difficulty underlined, John, by what we saw in Belfast and the toxic mix of social media and populist politicians and other things whipping up and ending up on violence in the streets because of an issue linked to migration. A horrendous attack. The perpetrator was caught, brought before the courts almost immediately, as quickly as possible, but it still didn't matter. It set off fires in Belfast. Now, Northern Ireland is its own place, but we've had it in Dublin as well. And we're back now talking about borders, aren't we?
Yeah. What happened in Belfast was mirrored by what happened in Dublin and at those horrific events. November 23rd, 2023. And, you know, it could as easily happen down here. But, you know, I mean, let's sincerely hope not. Yes, the question of, you see, right, Brexit changed things too. 10 years ago, later this month, that decision, and then we have the common travel area between Ireland and Britain and Northern Ireland. So that is probably the biggest, you know, sort of a rambling area in Europe, if you take the two islands. So what's to be done there? Of course, it was interesting to hear Sinn Féin and the DUP each calling for greater cooperation between Dublin and Belfast under the watchful eye of London. But of course, both of them have different reasons for looking for that. The DUP particularly, some of them saying it's time to get back to a hard border. Well, that can't happen. But there is ample EU provision for more targeted specific border controls. Nobody ever, when the free movement of people came in, there is a provision there that for security reasons, that can be suspended or varied at various times to allow security needs to be met. I mean, I think intelligence-led checks on migrants moving about could go a long way on this. I noticed that yesterday in Limerick, the Taoiseach said that he will be soon meeting Keir Starmer, the British Prime Minister, to discuss details on this.
And that will be, you know, continuing on the job of trying to maybe sort out. And it is an issue that isn't going to go away, the borders, John, that's for sure. In the meantime, John, we had a lot of doll time taken up this week by Ireland versus Israel and the ongoing saga of the Occupied Territories Bill and all of those sort of things to do with our position on Palestine and the continuing war in the Middle East, which continues to go on despite the promises every second day of US President Donald Trump. Taking up a lot of time, and there seems to be no resolution to it.
No, and it's a hard one. I mean, whatever decision ultimately comes out of this, it will satisfy nobody. It's an impossible situation. I mean, sports idealists will tell you there should never be politics in sport, given sport's social and economic reach. And this is where we came into this conversation. It is very hard to keep politics out of sport. Politics is an intrinsic part of sport. The point about politics, I suppose, is that it should be minimized and managed. And this is a difficult one to manage, because on the one hand, you have the atrocities perpetrated by Israel in Gaza and Lebanon. And on the other hand, you have Ireland's links into international sport and ongoing. And we have a history of this. For example, we have two soccer authorities on this island. Yeah, on this little island, something we should never have, but that's the history of it. The IRFU held up much better. But I think when you go back over, you know, some of the atrocities in the Troubles, for example, there were periodic suggestions that we shouldn't play. We shouldn't play England, questions about Scotland and Wales. And the reality is that would have broken up the IRFU, such a move. So there, to my mind, there should be ways found around the neutral venue option, which is still out there,
yeah.
Playing it somewhere like Hungary. It is a real option. And there is scope within that for Ireland to make a statement within the ambit of the game about our humanitarian views on Gaza or something like that. But the idea of just walking away from a fixture, you know, to me, it's
not reasonable.
It's very fraught.
Yeah. John, finally and briefly, all this talk, all these motions over Ireland, Israel, and not a single motion about Kerry and Kildare not being available to watch on television. Now, I know Mike Kennelly and Danny Healy-Ray were to the fore in giving out about this, but I know you're not bothered because you've got a ticket to the game. It won't bother you.
5:30. Well, the women are playing earlier. I think 3:30. The women are on at 5:30. Yes, I'm feeling very smug. I'm looking at the notice board here in front of me, and I have a pair of tickets up on the wall. So it won't be on any form of television, much to Mike Kennelly and Danny Healy-Ray's chagrin. But I hope I'll be there. I will be there. I know you're going to say it again. I'll say it for you. It'll be on Radio Kerry anyway.
Tim and Ambrose. Say hello to Tim and Ambrose if you see them, John.
Absolutely.
Brilliant. John, great stuff. Thanks a million for that. Enjoy the weekend. Enjoy the match. And thanks for going through 12 and all for us. John Downing there. If you've reviewed what he had to say on any of those issues, we want to hear from you in the programme.